you have your Bibles with you, we continue on in Revelation chapter 2, and beginning this morning in verse 8. And if you are willing and able, stand with me and we'll read these words of Jesus to his church together. Jesus says to the angel of the church in Smyrna, write, these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. I know your afflictions and your poverty, and yet you are rich. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt by the second death. Words of Christ for his people this morning. Have a seat. So we continue this morning with the second message from Jesus to one of these seven churches spread across the Roman province of Asia. Seven messages to seven churches, representative of all churches across space and time, and thus also Jesus' words for us sitting here this morning as well. And his message today, it comes to a church in a place called Smyrna, which is the only one of these cities in these seven letters that actually still exists. It's now the third most populous city in Turkey. It's a place called Izmir. At the time, though, Smyrna was a city of about 200,000 or so. Model city of Greece, it was. Called by its citizens the first amongst Asia. Renowned for its beauty, it was contentiously claimed to have been the birthplace of the epic poet Homer. And by this time this letter was written, it was a jewel in the Roman Empire as well. It was the first city outside Rome in the ancient world to be able to house a temple to the divine Roman state. And then a little later on, Smyrna won a competition amongst 10 other cities to be able to build a temple of the imperial cult to worship the emperor Tiberius. Smyrna also had a large Jewish community. By the time Revelation is written, we think around AD 90s, that kind of time period, things between the Jews and the Romans had kind of boiled over. Fringe groups of Jewish kind of extremists, I guess you'd call them, had gone to war with Rome, and it had culminated in tens of thousands of deaths, and then also the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, as Jesus had prophesied would happen. Christian persecution by Rome had also stepped up at the same time for these people who refused to bow the knee and say that Caesar was Lord. And so, weary of any more kind of negative attention from the empire, many Jews really tried to distance themselves from the Christian community. Remembering, of course, that in the early days of the church, the Jews who made up the church kind of didn't think of themselves as starting a church. They were Jews. They were holding out for the day when all of their brothers and sisters would come to know the truth of who Jesus was. But in places like Smyrna, where the empire was strong, sections of the Jewish community were just getting increasingly hostile towards the church, and they began to inform on them to stay in Rome's good books. Actually, a few years after this, one of the fathers of the ancient church, a man by the name of Polycarp, who was the bishop of Smyrna, he was burned alive in Smyrna for refusing to bow the knee to Caesar, and that was kind of the end point of an extensive persecution that had been instigated by the Jewish population there. All of that to say that Smyrna is a church under siege. It's located in an incredibly difficult context. It's a church surrounded on all sides by hostile cultural and religious forces. It's a church that consistently needs to be watching its back. It's a church populated by people who, because of their refusal to bow the knee to Rome, are being ostracized and cut off from the world around them. And yet, despite all of the difficulty, despite what are incredibly difficult circumstances to follow Jesus in this time and in this place, this church is a church that is standing strong. unlike Ephesus last week, where we saw that their witness had kind of grown weary in the sense that they'd forgotten why they kind of started in the first place. Smyrna is one of only two churches that Jesus sends messages to that for which he has nothing bad to say. They're doing a good job. And just like last week, in the face of all the trial, Jesus' word is that he knows about it. He knows about it. I know about your afflictions and your poverty, Jesus says. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. These are those Jews in Smyrna who had kind of actively turned against the church. Jesus doesn't mince his words. They might look like Jews on the outside, but internally their hearts are in a different place. They're more akin to the adversary or Satan than they are to God. All of that stuff that you're facing right now, I know about it, Jesus says. Can we pause maybe just for a moment just to acknowledge the simple power of Jesus knowing? Remembering, of course, Revelation is all about kind of showing things for the way that they truly are, reminding us of what is true even if we can't see it right now. Where is God when things are getting messy? Where is God when things go bad? Where is God when hard times come, when the world is against you? Does God even care? The word from Revelation is that these things are not hidden from God's sight. He knows about them. Actually, more than that, each of these letters, it kind of begins, you will have noticed probably, with a different way of Jesus describing himself. Last week at Ephesus, it was kind of an image that we'd found already in chapter 1. These are the words of him who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks among the seven golden lampstands. But this week in verse 8, these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. There's two central affirmations there in what's being said. Firstly, of Jesus' godliness. He's the first and the last. He's the awesome power that whispers and stars are born. He's the one who will be there at the end, the conclusion of all things, to restore and make new. So Jesus is God. And then two, of that godliness not being something off at a distance, but actually godliness that has entered into our reality. Godliness that has experienced the full spectrum of human experience and emotion, even to the point that he took on life and death itself. This is a reminder for Smyrna and for us that Jesus, he doesn't just know. He's been there as well. He's entered into the mess. This is a God who loved us enough that he would allow people to nail him to a cross so that everything that would keep us from life would be broken there with him, that a new way forward for humanity was possible. Jesus, he knows what it's like on a personal level. He identifies with them in their suffering. He joins them in it. And because of that, although they're facing affliction and literal material poverty, we read there, presumably because their faith has made it difficult to make a living in their context, still, Jesus says to them, "You are rich. You are rich." Pull back the curtain for a second and understand that faithfulness to Jesus, come what may, that is the currency of the kingdom of heaven. And Jesus, he tells them that their persistence and their faithfulness, it's paying off. What was it that he said when we were back in the Sermon on the Mount, that the last will be first and the first will be last? Don't bother storing up treasures on earth. Store up treasure in heaven, Jesus says. This is part of what it's about. It's a word to restore hope. And because of that, there comes another affirmation from Jesus. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. You know, maybe on hearing these words, on knowing that Jesus knows, that he identifies with them in what is going on, surrounded on all sides as they are by a world that wants nothing other than for them to be gone. Perhaps the church at Smyrna would have been forgiven for expecting that right then and there, in that precise moment, that Jesus was going to show up and do something about it. Maybe he's going to come and take their city by force. Maybe he's going to work mighty acts within it. Maybe he's going to smash the temples and structures of the evil empire. Maybe he's going to expose the wickedness of their neighbors and bring it out into the light. I mean, if Jesus knows, if Jesus is amongst it, then surely he's going to do something about it right now, isn't he? It's the lonely late night questioning of the recently diagnosed. It's the heartbroken pleading for the prodigal child. It's the cries when the darkness sets in. It's the desperate pleas as things fall apart once again that surely God will intervene this time. And yet in Smyrna, it doesn't seem to be the case. I know all about it, Jesus says. Do not be afraid, Jesus says. But actually, Jesus says, rather than getting better, things are only going to get worse. I tell you that the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death. You know, the reality that sometimes we don't want to hear, and that the live your best life now, Instagram-ready version of Christianity so pervasive in the privileged West doesn't want to preach to us either, is that maybe things aren't going to work out just now for us in the here and now. Maybe things aren't going to get better yet. That just because we walk with Jesus, it doesn't mean that things are going to go well for us. You know, we live in a suffering-averse culture. And sometimes that's rubbed off on the church in a bad way in parts of the world like this. And yet we have this vast tradition of faith being honed in suffering from which to draw. It should come as no surprise to us in here that those parts of life could be significant in helping shape who we are to be. I mean, from the captivity narratives of ancient Israel, the so often overlooked worship found in those Psalms of Lament, the encouragement and opposition of the prophets, the witness of a church that flourished in a hostile world, all bolstered by a God who literally walks amongst the suffering of this world and identifies with it and experiences it himself and then sends his people out to do the same. I mean, surely it's the case that we trust that in all things, not just in good things, but in all things, that God is working together for the good of those who love him. We can't guarantee that just because we walk with Jesus, things are going to go well. The witness of the church across history and across our world right now proves that just simply isn't true. But because Jesus walks with us, because he walks with us, our perspective on what we are facing can be altered. We can get what we need to persist in those spaces. Do not be afraid. Jesus says, do not be afraid. And actually, while we're here, you know, I think these words from Jesus, they kind of hit us in a slightly different way as well in the here and now, because, again, I think so much of the Christian response to the times that we're living in places of the world like this one, so much of it seems to be based in fear. You know, we're fearful of a swiftly changing world where the social and cultural shifts around us mean that the values that we grew up with don't seem to exist anymore. We're fearful of the way that that might impact our children, and so we try to shield them from it rather than helping them to engage critically with it. We're fearful of what change in the world out there will mean for us in here, the shape of our life as a community and the changes we might need to make in the future to live more authentically as witnesses to Jesus. And I get all of that because I fear those fears and I feel those fears sometimes as well. But we've got to hear again this morning that our calling isn't to run. I mean, that would just be taking the easy and slightly less faithful way out. Our calling also isn't to react against it, to resort to seeking power and influence of our own to get our way. I mean, got to look no further than American politics right now to know that that simply just doesn't work. Will do little to win a country for Jesus, it just ends up corrupting the church instead. Our calling in this time is as it has always been. It's to walk without fear in that compelling point of difference in the footsteps of Jesus. To be willing for our lives to be made difficult as a result of doing so. How much we can learn from our brothers and sisters around the world who, like Smyrna, are suffering for their faith in Christ right now, who are more than willing to do the hard yards of front foot engagement with the world. You know, a few weeks after many Christians in New Zealand got upset about the Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer being played as we remembered the Christchurch attacks together. A few weeks after that, I was watching a short documentary about a church in Indonesia. Indonesia, of course, having the world's largest Muslim population. This church had existed in a Muslim majority community for 20 or so years, and they were coming up against it. Neighbors were opposed to their existence, and eventually the government stepped in and sealed the doors of the church shut. And that church began to meet in secret for 3 years. And the pastor's talking on this video about that season and about how he was on the verge of giving up. And then just came under this real conviction that God was calling them out. That maybe they should take Jesus at his word when he said to love your neighbors and maybe even love your enemies as well. And so with that heart, they restarted church again, except this time with a free preschool to serve the poor in their area, with free pre- and postnatal classes for mums in the area, with an aerobics class for the women in the area, and then also a disaster relief coalition with some of the Muslim leaders in the area as well. All with a heart to serve and love their neighbors. The pastor said the only way is to bring the gospel to them. Otherwise, we lock it up in the church. And all of this because they decided to take Jesus at his word. Do not be afraid. Watch the church flourish in places like that, even as it diminishes here. Fear, it just stifles our witness. It chops us off at the knees. We need to learn to trust God just a little bit more. To believe enough that when he says, do not fear, that we can trust him with that. Because what might seem risky in the here and now, what might seem costly, what might push against the flow, it might be the case that that is precisely what God is calling us to do. And all of this only because of the entire point of this book that we're sitting in right now together. This book, which is all about lifting our eyes just a little bit higher to see which isn't immediately obvious to us. It's what Jesus is doing in Smyrna. He's encouraging them and he's commending their persistence in such adversity. He's showing them the way things really are. He reveals some of the bit players that are there. We get a glimpse. The adversary, the accuser, Satan, the devil, he gets a couple of mentions in there. And Smyrna are reminded when Jesus does that, that they're caught up in something with cosmic significance. That their problems in the here and now, that they have deeper and darker roots than what they could possibly imagine. But at the same time, the time is already counting down for those forces behind the scenes. They've lost the war already. Smyrna's persecution will have a limit, a finite time. That's what those 10 days are all about. It has a definite end. And for those who are faithful, even to the point of death, that certain inheritance comes, the victor's crown, life itself. The word that's used there for crown, it's not like crown like a king or a queen with the gold and all of that. No, it's the word that was used for the wreath that's awarded to winners in the ancient Olympic Games, for those who have literally run the race. The one who persists, who is victorious, will not be hurt by the second death, Jesus says to this church. They'll have nothing to fear when they stand before God at the end of all things, like we will one day as well. Now, this is going to be the reality that Revelation is going to impress on us time and time and time and time again. That our lives in the here and now, as important, as amazing as they can be, as troubling and difficult as they sometimes are, all of it is just a mere blip in a story that stretches on forever and ever and ever. You need to lift your eyes a little bit higher, Revelation is saying. Look, the all-powerful Jesus is walking amongst you. He's got a much bigger story for you to be a part of right now. He's got a much more hopeful, eternal future for you to walk into. Keep going. Don't lose faith. Do not fear. These are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. Are we listening? Are we listening?